HPPodcraft.com.
I had been dining with my ever-interesting friend, Mark Jenkins, at a little Italian restaurant near South Street. It was a chance meeting. Jenkins is too busy, usually, to make dinner arrangements. Over our highly seasoned food and sour, thin red wine, he spoke of little odd incidents and adventures of his profession. Nothing very vital or important, of course. Jenkins is not the sort of detective who first detects and then pours the egotistical and revealing details of achievement in the ears of every acquaintance, however appreciative. But when I spoke of something I had seen in the morning papers, he laughed. Poor old Doc Holt. Fascinating old codger to anyone who really knows him. I've had his friendship for years. Since I was first on the city force and saved a young assistant of his from jail on a false charge. And they had to drag him into the poisoning of this young sport, Ralph Peeler.
Poisoning of Ralph Peeler? Old codger Doc Holt. Mark Jenkins, private dick. Sounds like we got ourselves a bit of a crime drama here.
Yeah, and you can't hear it in that reading, but when he says Doc Holt, Doc is in quotation marks.
Yeah.
So maybe that crime is medical malpractice.
Woo!
Perhaps. We'll find out.
That is from the opening of Francis Stevens' Unseen, Unfeared, a story that feels like a big ripoff of From Beyond, but was published 1 year before Lovecraft wrote his story.
Wow.
So we're going to talk about this on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
We're here at HPPodcraft.com. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey.
Who recommended this story to us? We've been getting recommendations from listeners.
Yeah, we've taken a couple recommendations from this listener before. William Reeder or Writer, I'm not sure which. Hopefully he'll write me in and correct me. Yeah. So thank you so much for suggesting this story. There was lots of interesting things about it, and we're going to talk about it.
I really liked it a lot. Our reader this week is Heather Klinke, VO artist extraordinaire.
Yeah.
She is available for hire if you need any voiceover artist stuff for your personal project. Also, I just want to mention there's another podcast that some friends of ours do called The Horror of Nachos and Hamantaschen. It's pretty fun. They cover some things that we talk about here on the show, but then also get into horror movies. Anyway, they asked me to come on the show and did an episode where they just interviewed me. Maybe that's of interest to folks. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But go check it out. They're great guys, JR and Derek, and the show is fun. I posted links on our social media, but I'll also put them up in our show notes. The Horror of Nachos and Hamantaschen.
Yeah, I love Hamantaschen's writing. He is one of my favorite modern horror authors, hands down.
Yes, and Derek, the editor of Nacho Anomicon, he introduced us to all kinds of interesting nacho facts and trivia, so.
And he's a mensch.
And he's a mensch. It's a good pair, those guys.
Speaking of good guys, why aren't we on Wikipedia? What's up with that?
I wonder that sometimes myself. I guess we just don't really rate.
I guess we're not up there, because I looked up our movie, The Chosen One, which is on Wikipedia. It's got an entry.
Yeah.
And we're on there, but when you click our names, there's nothing.
Yeah, they're in red because we don't rate. And I really kind of wish the basics were on there, at least, so that later we could get people to add the fake stuff that, you know, when Wikipedia gets fun, like put in that I used to be a ventriloquist dummy but was endowed with life by a creepy wizard. Put in that, you know, you're part polar bear.
That's true, actually. My great grandmother on my father's side.
Oh, is that what it will see? If that went into Wikipedia, it definitely would be true. But I don't want to necessarily start with that stuff. I'd like to just have the facts. It's a goal.
So right now, let's get some background on this author, Francis Stevens.
Mm-hmm.
Francis Stevens was a pen name used by Gertrude Barrows Bennett. She's a super big deal, a trailblazer in the fantasy and science fiction genre. She's also been called the woman who invented dark fantasy.
That's right. I read the story actually not realizing that the writer was a woman.
Yeah, me too.
The big surprise is after I found out that it really didn't make any difference at all.
Nope.
That did not bring with it any huge revelations. But what about Gertrude?
She was born in 1883 in Minneapolis. She got an 8th grade education and studied to be an illustrator, but that didn't really work out for her. So she eventually became a stenographer, a job she did for the rest of her life.
Yeah, on and off.
She married a British journalist, Stuart Bennett, in 1909 and moved to Philly with him.
Right. I think that this story that we're doing today is set in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
Stuart was a journalist, was also an explorer, and he would cover expeditions. And right after they got married, he went on one of those and things didn't work out so well.
Yeah, he died a year later after they were married, and she had a new baby girl.
Right.
So Oh, near the end of World War One, her father dies, so she has to take care of her invalid mother. Bam, bam.
Yes, the jet-setting life of a dark fantasy author. Take care of a baby and an invalid. Here you go.
So she moved to California and wrote between 1917 and 1923 while she was taking care of her mother.
Yeah, she published 5 short stories, 7 longer works of fiction, all of which appeared in pulp magazines like Argosy, All Story Weekly, and our favorite Weird Tales.
Yeah.
Now, at the age of 17, she wrote her first short story. It was science fiction called The Curious Experience of Thomas Dunbar. She mailed it to Argosy, which was the huge pulp magazine at the time, and it was accepted and published in the March 1904 issue. So she'd already been published before, had a little early success, but then wasn't writing for a long time. Cut to 1917 when she was in the situation you're talking about. She starts writing again as a means to help support the family, which always seems like a harebrained scheme to me, but...
Yeah, I know.
She met with some success. The first story she knocked out was called The Nightmare, which appeared in All Story Weekly. And this is where Gertrude started using the pseudonym Frances Stevens, but it wasn't her creation. For that story, if it were to be published, she wanted to use the pseudonym Jean Vale, which I think is a pretty good one.
Yeah.
But the editor said, no, you're Frances Stevens. And so that's how the story got published, and it got positive feedback. So she said, OK, I'm just going to keep using that pseudonym,
sure.
Which it reminded me weirdly of Michelle Yeoh, the martial arts star.
Yeah.
Because I, the first time I saw her movies, she was billed as Michelle Kahn.
Oh, right. Yeah.
That's how I knew her. So I heard that like a German journalist made it up or something, but it wasn't her creation. Somebody just said, you're Michelle Kahn now.
Oh, whoa.
That's how she was presented for a long time, till finally she was famous enough to say, no, that's actually not my name. But the thing about that story that Gertrude published, The Nightmare, is that it was very similar to The Land That Time Forgot, which is a very famous novel by Edgar Rice Burroughs.
Mm-hmm.
And that also came out a year after she wrote The Nightmare.
Oh, whoa.
That was one of my favorite books when I was a kid. And now I find out it was ripped off from some broad? That just cheapens everything. This woman seems to be behind all my favorite science fiction.
Wow.
But I also believe that one of her novels was a lost world fantasy called The Citadel of Fear, which people say is a real classic of that lost world subgenre. When that book was republished in 1952, that was the first time people were actually using her real name instead of Frances Stevens. She also wrote 2 other novels that were accepted for publication by a magazine that then folded, so those manuscripts were completely lost, which is really too bad.
Wow.
And I say too bad because listen to some of these synopses for her other works. She's got a story called Friend Island. It's set in a 22nd century ruled by women.
Nice.
Like it already. Another story is the novel Serapion, which was an Argosy in 1920. It's about a man possessed by a supernatural creature. Actually, maybe we want to cover that. That sounds interesting. Yeah. And she wrote a science fiction novel, The Heads of Cerberus, one of the very first dystopian novels. The book features a gray dust from a silver vial, which transports anyone who inhales it to a totalitarian Philadelphia of 2118 AD.
What?
She was coming up with some crazy stuff. One of her most famous novels is called Claimed, which... It originally appeared in Argosy in 1920. In that novel, a supernatural artifact summons an ancient and powerful god to 20th century New Jersey.
Whoa.
So all this stuff sounds amazing. Begs to be developed, young executives, so get on this author.
She became estranged with her daughter, so when she actually died is a bit of a mystery. They thought it was 1939, but some newer research says that she was around longer and didn't die until 1948.
Yeah, that's her death certificate says 1948. So I think people assumed, well, why did they think it was 39? Because
I've got it from Wikipedia.
It had something to do with her relationship with her daughter. But we don't have much information about her or why she was interested in writing this kind of material.
No.
What piqued her interest, who she liked as authors. Certainly the pulps were dominated by men at that time. And also curious why she stopped writing if she lived so much longer than
them. So the story starts off with these two guys having dinner. Our protagonist Blaisdell and his buddy, ex-cop Private Dick Leroy Jenkins.
Mm-hmm.
It's Mark Jenkins. You totally missed that one.
I did.
Jenkins.
I'm not that bright. I was confused because I don't know if he's an ex-cop or a private detective. I think he might be a detective for the police. I think he's a detective in the police force. It doesn't say either way, but that's the impression I get.
Yeah, the impression I got is that he was an ex-cop, but I could be wrong.
Ex-cop and private detective is a more interesting character because that means he doesn't play by the rules.
Yeah. So they're talking about this case that made the paper, something about this guy, Dr. Steve Holt. Steve Holt! They never say his name is Steve, of course. I just figured that if you're going to have last name Holt, your first name should be Steve.
Sure. And that reference I got, that's from Arrested Development, right?
Yeah.
Yes. But they do actually say his name in the story. It's Frederick Holt.
They do?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I missed that. Jenkins says that the guy had gotten a bad rap before, this Holt fella. He was brought in for the poisoning of this guy, Ralph Peeler.
We're not getting much information, but there were a couple of things in that opening I thought were interesting.
Uh-huh.
First of all, are they eating at Olive Garden? Because the meal sounds terrible. highly seasoned food and sour, thin red wine. And then also there's a little character thing. It says the detective, he doesn't brag about his detecting.
Right.
He's not your typical, and then guess what I did.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if that's true. I think that's just the narrator's perspective, because he also says Jenkins is super busy and this was just a chance meeting. I feel like Jenkins was walking by the Olive Garden and the narrator was like, hey, saw him and was like, hey, Jenkins, what's going on? Because I bet, you know, Jenkins actually does tell his detecting tales to other people, but he just doesn't want to get into it with this guy.
So this Doc Holt, he's a chemist, but he sort of rides the line between science and superstition. He sold love potions and tonics and such. Mm. Folks in the neighborhood thought he was always up to no good. So when something fishy happened, they point the finger at him.
Right. He lives in some kind of swarthy, immigrant, poverty-stricken neighborhood. He doesn't even need to. He's got money, but for some reason, that's where he wants to be. And the foolish immigrant people there, they're all suspicious of his work. I'm not even sure if he sells love potions or if that's just something they say about him.
Yeah.
Because they know he's up there practicing chemistry. And, you know, why have a lab if you're not making love potions? What other reason could you possibly have?
Jenkins offers Blaisdell a cigar and he lights up. Jenkins says that he's talking too much and Blaisdell replies, you open up with all the frankness of a Chinese diplomat.
As in he doesn't really talk that much at all.
He doesn't talk that much. Jenkins just smiles and gets up and says he's got to leave to meet with this guy.
Check out this next sentence. It totally confirms my Olive Garden scenario. He so clearly did not invite my further company that I remained seated for a little while after his departure. Then took my own way homeward.
Starts walking home. He's on the streets of the city and he starts getting a bit racist. He's feeling overwhelmed with a sense of fear. And it says here, the mixture of Italians, Jews, and a few Negroes, mostly bareheaded, unkempt, and generally unhygienic in appearance, struck me as merely revolting. They were all humans, and I, too, was human. Some way, I did not like the idea.
Yeah. Well, this is interesting, this passage. To know that he's human and then these terrible, you know, minorities are also human makes him disgusted with them and with himself. So it seems like right out of Lovecraft.
Yeah.
But the narrator seems uneasy that he's having Lovecraftian racist thoughts. It says,
yes,
this puzzled a trifle, for I am more inclined to sympathize with poverty than accuse it. I mean, I think this is out of the ordinary.
Yes.
And so he thinks maybe it doesn't seem right. I'm having these feelings like maybe it's the Olive Garden wine. You know, who knows? It even says who knew how that stuff had been manufactured or whether the juice of a grape entered at all into its ill-flavored composition.
So Blaisdell says that everyone seems to be angry and ready to get violent with him at any moment. Is this going to be one of those kinds of stories? One of those racist Horror of Red Hook kind of things?
Yeah, I wasn't sure at this point.
Blaisdell comes across a drugstore and he wants to go in and sit down because he's feeling so crazy and paranoid right now. But before he gets into this drugstore, he sees a sign. It says, see the great unseen. Come in. This means you. Free to all. And he thinks, okay, that'll get me off the street. Sure, let's do it.
Right, and at this point, I was sure that he was about to meet some Scientologists, right? That
yeah.
Seemed like what the setup would be. He'd go in and they go, now you're ready to be audited? And wait a minute.
The dread is increasing and he's feeling really off his game. He's almost staggering around looking for the entrance to this place. He's not sure where to go because there's a bunch of doors. It's sort of this weird residential area as well. So he doesn't want to accidentally go into somebody's house.
Right.
Just as he's about to go in, he sees this family of Italians walking down the street and they're all done up like they're going to go to a wedding or a dance or something like that. And this handsome young man, for an Italian guy, gives him a
that's
look.
In the story. That's not you saying that.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, this guy looks at him. They lock eyes and they kiss.
What?
I just thought that would be good. They lock eyes and he gives Blaisdell this most evil smile, like super malevolent. This really freaks Blaisdell out. So he tosses his cigar and hurries inside. And this entryway is very grimy, but he steps inside and his fear is gone.
It's really strange that this is supposed to be some exhibition or show, yet it feels like he's just inside some apartment building.
Yeah.
Like, is this even where I'm supposed to be?
Just as Blaisdell's about to leave, this old guy steps out and just says, well, and Blaisdell says, I came to see the great unseen and I'm a bit lost. Can you tell me which door is the right one? And the old guy just says, I can. And then there's this long and comfortable pause.
Right.
Then Blaisdell says, if you can and won't, then never mind. You know, he's ticked. And so he turns to leave. And the old guy apologizes, says folks never come in, so he's just a bit surprised. They are too scared, he says, of what he's got going on here. Mm-hmm. Then he pats the door that he just came out of and says, this is the door. Now, Blaisdell, for some reason, that fear that he's been feeling, that terror, just starts coming back again. Blaisdell says, I'm the only audience member? That will be an interesting experience. And the old guy says, in all seriousness, the most interesting in the world.
Hmm.
So the old guy goes into the door, but closes it behind him, kind of shutting it in Blaisdell's face. And he thinks, okay, now I'm leaving. But yeah. The old guy sticks his head back in and says, you know, come on, follow me.
And then he closes the door on him again.
Yeah.
Which I got a good chuckle out of that. And I have to say, Gertrude, she really knows how to do awkward.
Yeah.
And the subject material in here is very pioneering. We've read so many things like this,
uh-huh.
this from Beyondish kind of story. In fact, I was thinking The Diamond Lens, which we've covered before.
Right.
Fitz James O'Brien. It would have predated this, and that was another hidden universe kind of story. But the stuff that's really getting me off here are these little narrative touches, the small stuff.
Yeah.
The little bits of awkwardness. I think they're great. Anyhow, the narrator thinks, well, maybe he's got something in there, like an animal that he doesn't want to run out or something.
Sure.
No way it's a dangerous animal. I got to stop being afraid. I'm just going to go in. So he enters.
The room looks like some kind of laboratory. White porcelain, strange apparatuses, jars lining the walls with specimens inside them. And there's a large table in the center of the room with this camera-looking thing on it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a few chairs in the room and a sink in the corner.
And the old guy, we didn't describe him, but he's got he's got crazy white hair and deep black eyes. And he says, sit down. Have no fear but that you will be interested, my friend. Have no fear at all of anything. There's a preoccupation on the part of this old man with, you don't need to be afraid. Don't be afraid.
Yeah.
And of course, that's all the narrator feels.
He feels super afraid. It's freaking him out. So this old guy starts doing his act, which is kind of like a lecture. Since Blaisdell is freaking out from his newfound anxiety that he's experiencing right now, he's really not listening to what's going on. And as he tunes back in, the old guy is talking about photoplates and photographing organisms. Funny bit here, the old guy says, now, in color work of every kind, the film is necessarily extremely sensitive. Doubtless you're familiar in a general way with the exquisite transparencies produced by color photography of the single plate type. Then Blaisdell says, oh, I saw some nice landscapes done in that way last week at the illustrated lecture in Franklin Hall. But the old guy just kind of gives him this dirty look and says, I can proceed better without interruptions. My pause was purely oratorical. Well, la-dee-da.
And it's more awkwardness.
Yeah.
And I also loved the way the narrator's attention drifts in and out during this section. As a writing device, this is actually smart because it cuts out any long ranting that we would have to hear and allows the reader to just get only the most important snippets. But it also tells me something about the narrator. Maybe he's got a little ADD, because if he starts thinking about something else, he just stops listening.
Right.
You know, so maybe this is why the detective doesn't tell him any stories. Like, hey, Blaisdell, you have to be able to pay attention for more than 30 seconds, dude.
We do find out that something else is going on with him. Mm-hmm. So maybe it's just that.
Sure.
The old guy goes back to his talk and says that these microorganisms are very small and hard to photograph in color. They have to use a lot of sensitive chemicals, and the red light that they use in developing is too strong and ruins these pictures. So he's been using these tissue sheets that are kind of green-yellow over the bulb, and he's found this one that is perfect. And it's a strange tissue paper that he got from his pharmacist when they wrapped the pills that he got from his pharmacist in. It doesn't say what those pills are. The old guy asks where they got it, and the pharmacist says, oh, some drug company in South America came in with a shipment. I just used it because it was around.
It's completely random that he got this sheet of tissue paper that happens to be perfect for what he's doing.
Right.
The druggist had it at hand, so he used it, and that's a little reminiscent of The Call of Cthulhu.
Yes.
How in that, there's that crowning piece of evidence. It's just a stray sheet of newspaper that's used to wrap something up. So mm-hmm. You know, I thought that little plot device was interesting as well.
Well, this mystery paper turned his white light green.
Yeah, it fixes whatever issues he was having trying to photograph these things.
Now, nothing he's seeing is scary, but the narrator is totally freaking out over this old guy. And the old guy just laughs and says, you know, I'm not going to tell you what I saw when I put this paper on this light, but I'm going to show you.
And then he has a little evil scientist ranting here that's a little similar to From Beyond, right?
Yeah.
When our poor, faultily sensitive vision can perceive a thing, we say that it is visible. When the nerves of touch can feel it, we say that it is tangible. Yet I tell you, there are beings intangible to our physical sense, yet whose presence is felt by the spirit, and invisible to our eyes merely because those organs are not attuned to the light as reflected from their bodies. I mean, this stuff could be right out of From Beyond.
Yeah. Blaisdell is freaking out. But he's just quietly sitting there, you know, in his head, he's freaking out. But physically, he's not doing anything nutty. Then the lights go out and he can hear the old guy fiddling around with something in the dark.
We've all been there.
What? His eyes start to adjust and he turns his lamp camera thing on and then he slides in the South American membrane and
right.
The whole room lights up.
My eyes fixed themselves, fascinated, on something that moved by the old man's feet. It writhed there on the floor like a huge, repulsive starfish, an immense, armed, legged thing that twisted convulsively. It was smooth, as if made of rubber, was whitish-green in color, and presently raised its great round blob of a body on tottering tentacles, crept toward my host and writhed upward, yes, climbed up his legs, his body. And he stood there, erect, arms folded, and stared sternly down at the thing which climbed. But the room, the whole room was alive with other creatures than that. Everywhere I looked, they were centipedish things with yard-long bodies, detestable furry spiders that lurked in the shadows, and sausage-shaped translucent horrors that moved and floated through the air. They dived here and there between me and the light, and I could see its bright greenness through their greenish bodies. Worse, though, far worse than these were the things with human faces. Mask-like, monstrous, huge, gaping mouths and slit-like eyes. I find I cannot write of them. There was about them which makes their memory even now intolerable.
This is so totally from beyond. I can't believe it. Mm-hmm. There are things that exist around us that we can't see, and it just requires a different shift in perspective to witness all these horrible things. The old guy, he is explaining while all these creatures and crazy things are going on around that these things, they come from humans. Humans make them out of their evil thoughts, their selfishness, and their fear.
Right. So these aren't just species that exist that have not, that might have their own intention. We're creating all of this business. And our narrator has been feeling all sorts of fear, thinking all sorts of evil thoughts about the people in the neighborhood.
Uh-huh.
And then the guy says to him, "Fear nothing, but see where there comes to you its creator, the shape and the body of your fear."
Mm.
And as he said it, the narrator perceives this great thing coming toward him.
And as he's talking, this crazy evil thing freaks him out so much, he just passes out.
Yes, fainting spell.
Now I understand why the old guy keeps saying, "Fear nothing."
Right, because
don't fear anything. Yeah.
Fear creates the worst monsters.
So he wakes up in the laboratory. He's all crampy, so he knows he's been there a while. Like, his body hurts. So he's been passed out in that chair for a very long time. The old guy is gone. The room is just lit up from streetlights outside. No creepy green machine light. He wants to leave, but he feels so sick and dizzy, and he's got this terrible headache that he just can't get up. And he's resting there just until he can pull himself together and get out. Maybe the old guy's going to come back and help him.
Mm-hmm.
Blaisdell also starts thinking about the evil people that are outside, and his fears just start pouring back again.
Well, it's not just the people outside either. After seeing these things, he starts to meditate on his own evilness.
Right.
And there's a really great passage here. As fatuitously trustful as a month-old puppy, I had lived in a grim, evil world where goodness is a word and crude selfishness the only actuality. Super pessimistic turn here. Drearily, my thoughts drifted back through my own life, its futile purposes, mistakes, and activities. All of evil that I knew returned to overwhelm me. Our gropings towards divinity were a sham, a writhing sunward of slime-covered beasts who claimed sunlight as their heritage, but in their hearts preferred the foul and easy depths. And this is a really interesting passage because it exposes his racism earlier as something monstrous.
Yeah. So it's not that kind of story.
Yeah, it's not.
Then he thought of the monsters and how his evil thoughts are adding to the monsters. And he thinks, well, I got to stop the monsters. And the only way to do that is to kill himself.
Which culminates in the greatest two sentences ever written in the English language. "One good thing I could do, if one only, I could abolish my monster creating self."
It's good.
My monster creating self.
So we cut back to Jenkins' private dick.
Uh-huh.
He got his cigar, we find out, from this guy Callahan he was investigating about the poisoning of Peeler.
Yeah, it's a little confusing, but if you remember, people were saying the doctor was connected to the poisoning of this guy. Whether that's true or not, he's investigating. But he's got the cigars.
So, and he has his own cigars as well, which is confusing because he's supposed to have the cigar from this Peeler guy in evidence. But guess what? He mixed up and he gave Blaisdell the tainted cigar. Whoops.
Right, because there had been the poisoning had happened via, you know, the cigar had been the thing that transferred the poison to this peeler guy.
Right.
And he had another poisoned cigar, but yeah, he got it mixed up with his own, and that's what he gave to our narrator when he left him at the Olive Garden.
Yeah, and so that's why he's freaking out. He's having this crazy, you know, freak out. Jenkins found this Italian friend of his, Pietro Marini, who was coming home from dance. Marini was the guy who looked at him with the Italian family, you know, the one that gave him the sexy face that scared him. The reason he was looking at him was that Blaisdell looked like he was the sickest person he had ever seen. Like,
right. It wasn't a look of anger and evil. It was like surprise and concern.
Yes. Since the place he was going into was Doc Holt's. Huh? So the guy that they're talking about at the beginning, Doc Holt, is the dude that's running this whole see the creatures from the other dimensions thing.
Yeah. It's a little confusing because Jenkins, he knows, well, he says he knows there was a young man there who's running some kind of lecture deal where he's showing lantern slides of microorganisms and bacteria. And those slides have been provided by Dr. Holt.
Right.
I don't know why we introduced this other character.
Yeah.
But that's who's supposedly doing the shows. Anyway, because he knows that, because the Italian told him that the narrator was going up there, he says, I better get over there because he might be in a lot of trouble being poisoned.
Exactly. Jenkins goes to the place. He finds what's left of the cigar outside, because remember, he pitched his cigar before he went in. And then he goes inside. Jenkins got inside and he finds Blaisdell trying to find a chemical to ingest.
Right, in his suicide mission.
And all the evil in the faces he had seen that night, all the problems he's been having were, of course, drug-induced hallucinations.
It was all the poison cigar.
When they're talking, Blaisdell discovers that Holt was dead there.
Really confusing.
Really confusing.
It says, following something Jenkins told me, I was driven to one protest. If Holt was not here, I demanded. If Holt is dead, as you say. So that's the first, that's how we realize that Doc Holt is actually dead.
Yeah.
Is him saying, if Holt is dead, as you say, so.
Yeah, Holt died before Blaisdell came in. And then Blaisdell's like, no, I saw him. I saw him. I know what he looks like.
Yeah, how could I describe him to you if he's dead?
And then Jenkins goes, well, there's a picture of him in the lab. Your mind must have done something strange and made him the guy in your hallucination. Jenkins wants to take him to the hospital, and he says he'll walk because he needs to get some fresh air. And then Jenkins is like, fresh air in South Street in July? Yeah, right.
He says, okay, we'll just go for a walk. I won't take you to the hospital. Good thing you didn't smoke that whole cigar, or you'd be dead. Like, he's being pretty jovial about it.
But something doesn't quite jive with Blaisdell.
Right, and it has to do with the explanation for that awkward door-closing scene. I mean, the reason Jenkins is saying, the reason it seemed like the door closed in your face twice by Dr. Holt was because you were the one that went up and unlatched it and opened it. He couldn't let you in because you had to open the door. That's why it seemed like it was closed.
Blaisdell's like, I saw him in the hall before I ever went into the lab. So how could my mind make him up if I saw him before I ever saw the picture? And then
Jenkins, yeah, he didn't see the crayon drawing until he went in.
Yeah. So Jenkins says, your memories are just all confused.
Right, but it's crazy because now Gertrude is implying that maybe this did happen. It was some kind of supernatural experience. The drugging can't explain it.
So Blaisdell goes over to the camera device thing and he finds the tissue slide and pulls it out. And Jenkins says, should we put it in the lamp and try it?
I looked him straight in the eyes. No, I said, we won't. I was drugged. Perhaps in that condition I received a merciless revelation of the discovery that caused Holt's suicide. But I don't believe it. Ghost or no ghost, I refuse to ever again believe in the depravity of the human race. If the air and the earth are teeming with invisible horrors, they are not of our making, and the study of demonology is better let alone. Shall we burn this thing or tear it up? We have no right to do either, returned Jenkins thoughtfully. But you know, Blaisdell, there's a little too darn much realism about some parts of your dream. I haven't been smoking any dope cigars, but when you held that up to the light, I'll swear I saw... Well, never mind. Burn it. Send it back to the place it came from. South America, said I. A hotter place than that. Burn it. So he struck a match, and we did. It was gone in one great white flash. A large place was given by morning papers to the suicide of Dr. Frederick Holt. Caused, it was surmised, by mental derangement brought about by his unjust implication in the Peeler murder. It seemed an inadequate reason, since he had never been arrested, but no other was ever discovered. Of course, our action in destroying that membrane was illegal and rather precipitate, but though he won't talk about it. I know that Jenkins agrees with me. Doubt is sometimes better than certainty, and there are marvels better left unproved. Those, for instance, which concern the powers of evil.
Powers of evil is capitalized there at the end. I love that.
Yeah, that's the end of the story.
So Doc Holt, he committed suicide.
Yeah. Yeah, it ends a little confusing. I had to reread it a few times I didn't quite understand what had transpired. Yeah.
There's a little bit of clumsiness in the execution of the plot.
Yeah.
But I do really like this story.
Yeah.
And I thought it had great moments in it. And I want to look at some more. I keep saying Gertrude, but Francis Stevens. Work. You know, I think it'd be fun to cover some more of that on the show.
I'm also trying to find out if there was any connection to Lovecraft and if he liked her stories. Supposedly, there was a letter that Lovecraft wrote that said he did like her stories. But then I also heard that letter was actually not Lovecraft and was attributed to him, but it was somebody else that said that. So I don't know if Lovecraft actually ever read any of this stuff before.
Seems like he would have.
I feel like it's right around the right time, the right period before he had written all these things. So, I don't know. If anybody happens to know if there is any documentation of whether or not Lovecraft checked this stuff out, I couldn't find it, but that doesn't mean anything because, you know, I'm just a chump.
I agree, and I'm a chump as well. I couldn't confirm that was true or not, but one would think, since though she was publishing in the pulps that he was reading at the time.
Yeah. So
it seems like he would have had access to this.
Exactly. So next week, we are going to do another story by Manly Wade Wellman.
Is that a professional wrestler?
I like to think so. Called Oh Ugly Bird.
Great. Oh Ugly Bird. I don't know anything about
me neither.
That at all. So but I have heard Manly Wade Wellman before.
I can't wait to find out about Manly Wade Wellman and whether or not he can perform the Superfly Snuka. I want to thank Heather Klinke for rocking and rolling and getting this good stuff out.
Yes, I love it. I love her. I'm glad that she came back on a red again.
She's a delight.
Yeah, Manly Heather Klinke, I call her. So we'll be getting on that story next week. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in to this subscriber show. We appreciate your support. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast
at hppodcraft.com.
hppodcraft.com.